Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you so much for joining me. This is Greg Soden. My guest on this episode is Matilda Bickers. The topic of this conversation is the book Working It, Sex Workers on the Work of Sex, which Bickers edited with Peach Brashears and Janice Luna, and also contributed her own writing. This anthology was released by PM Press in March of 2023. Matilda Bickers is an artist and writer originally from Boston's South End. Her experience in sex work, which she entered at age 18, has enabled her to focus on art and activism and the vital intersection of the two. As you can probably discern, this conversation is about sex work and the material is mature in nature. Please be advised that the conversation contains mature language and subject matter throughout. Thank you so much for listening. Matilda Bickers, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
I'm delighted that you're here. I'm wondering if you can just spend a moment and introduce yourself a little bit to the listeners out there so they know a little bit about you and the work that you do.
Sure. So my name is Matilda. I moved to Portland in 2001, and immediately, like, there was a very active sex worker activism scene in Portland at the time. And I had just been like, I was 17. I was like, I don't know what to do with myself. Don't want to go to college. Don't really have any skills. And that was like, I was like, oh, there's a viable career path that gives you time. That was what I was looking for, is like time to just work on projects and art. And that's what these women were doing. It was so amazing. They were making art. They were making movies. They were lobbying at City Hall. They had a needle exchange team, and then they went out and picked up needles from some of the areas that have now been gentrified and look totally different. And they also did art shows and had a zine. And I was just so, it was really life-changing and life-saving. And I was just so impressed by them. And they'd been doing it for almost 10 years at the time. And so they went dormant in 2002 and gradually dissolved. And I was like, well, that's my life's goal, is to restart this work. Like, we need it desperately. Portland is a town with a lot of strip clubs, a lot of sex workers. And it left this huge gap. And so when I was 28 or 29, I ended up suing my club, the club that I was working at the time, for misclassification and battery. It had a really terrible culture of basically sexual abuse. And I won. Well, we settled. We settled for batteries so that they wouldn't have to admit that they were misclassifying their workers. And I used that and a grant that I got from an agency called Cascade AIDS Project to start Stroll, which was a street outreach program. We did a zine. It was basically like as close to Danzine as I could get with the much smaller group that I was organizing with. And so for, I think we went dormant in 2002. So for about 6 or 7 years, we were doing a zine. We did art shows. We did needle exchange, and we brought food and clothes and supplies to the local houseless camps. We ended up focusing a lot more on houseless outreach than on sex worker stuff, just because in around, I guess, 2015, the unhoused population here just exploded. And it seemed like there was just this need that wasn't being met. And, you know, since COVID, luckily, there are so many mutual aid groups that have bloomed in Portland that are doing the same work. So it felt pretty good to go dormant and know that that work was being covered by a lot of other people. And I started nursing school. So I was like, I really don't have the energy to keep doing this. And I just, yeah, but at some point I'd like to go back to it.
Awesome. Well, okay. So you moved to Portland 2001. How did you find that community when you first went there? Because I mean, I'm just curious about like where you kind of like find your people whenever you get to Portland for the first time.
I, you know, I I remember looking online specifically, like I'd heard that there was a lot of strip clubs in Portland, and I was already like, well, maybe I could be a stripper. Like I was getting street harassed all the time. And I was like, obviously I'm attractive. Like, can I do something with this? And so I think I found like red stockings, maybe like an old 90s zine from maybe Seattle sex workers. And that led me to Danzine. And I was like, oh, they're here. There's sex workers doing stuff here in this town. And so I immediately emailed them. I had a meeting with Morgan LaFay, who was one of the organizers in Danzine, and they were just so warm and welcoming and supportive. It was really funny because I was underage at the time. I wasn't really supposed to be volunteering with them, so they gave me a little bracelet that said minor, and that everyone knew, like at functions, don't give her alcohol. And yeah, they were just great.
Gotcha. Well, I am really intrigued by your story as well. And so you have this deep knowledge. So I'm reading your book. I have read your book that you have put out. It's called Working It, Sex Workers on the Work of Sex, which came out from PM Press. And before we dive into the book itself and the work that you did to put this collection together, the thing that strikes me deeply about your work is just how sex work is so diverse. And I'm wondering if there is like a need to know basic overview of the sex work industry that you feel like everybody in society needs to know, regardless if they like of their levels of involvement in the work of sex workers.
Yeah, I guess the diversity of it is something that people don't really understand. Sex work is an umbrella term coined by Carol Lee, I think in the 70s or 80s. And it just covers anything where you're exchanging, you know, money or goods, or, you know, you're exchanging a sexual or sexualized service. So like a lap dance would be a sexualized service, or, you know, images for some kind of gain. And people don't tend to, you know, like technically I would think like women who stay married, you know, for housing, I would kind of consider them sex workers, but that's, you know, that's making it really broad. And politically, because of the criminalization and stuff, it's kind of better to narrow it down to the people that are affected by stigma, which would be like most what you think of when you think of sex workers. So like cam girls, strippers, or cam workers, strippers, escorts, the people who are most stigmatized by it and most need, you know, the kind of outreach and changing of people's minds. I guess it's more efficient to think of them, but I really, like, I think there's a lot of things that should be, you know, considered more, like looked at more closely. Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. So I want to know what a little bit of the planning stages of putting together the book, Working It. You mentioned the zine, and you know, I'm curious if the zine and the book have any relationship to each other. I'm curious about just like the planning stages of how you realize, like, I want to do a book about the work of sex workers in general.
Well, I was always, you know, fascinated by it. I was just like so delighted that this was a way to make a living when I was younger. Eventually I got burned out and I'm less delighted by sex work now than I was when I was a teenager. But for a long time, I was just like, I can't believe that like, this is a way to make a living and survive. This is so like how blessed, you know, like I have all this free time to work on projects and to do things. So I was initially fascinated by it and I loved it. And I just that, you know, that love for the ability to survive has stuck with me. And the kinds of people who, you know, who are drawn to sex work or who end up in sex work and what they do with the, you know, the free time and money that sex work gives them. I mean, it doesn't work out that way for everybody, but you know, there's like survival sex workers and stuff and who are just trying to get by and who might not be focused on making art. But I just am interested in all of those stories, you know, like if you're living on the margins, and it's not exclusive to sex workers. I'm interested in the stories that don't get told, you know, that aren't in the mainstream media. And so, yeah, I've always wanted to hear those. And so as soon as I got the chance to like amplify those stories, to seek them out and to share them, I was all in. And that was a part of what I loved about Danzine is that they did that. So yeah, I started the zine and it was just like the fulfillment of my teenage dream. I was like, yeah. And the book, you know, I was like, maybe someday someone will want an anthology of this, but I didn't really believe it. Cause most of what gets published by sex workers is, you know, like fluff. Like, I love drinking cum out of a martini glass, you know, and less about, like, it's not that great of a job all the time. Sometimes you get abused and it really sucks. But yeah, I randomly, through a friend, heard that PM Press was looking for a sex worker anthology. And so I sent them Working It and they were interested. And that was just, I was just like floored and so excited. And I initially, you know, it was 2020. So I had all this free time from the pandemic and I was like, I can do this in 3 months, you know, which after, I think at the time I'd been doing it for 5 years and every issue of the zine was such a chore to put out, you know, because people have other priorities. I would be like pulling teeth, like, please, please send this to me. You know, the zine went from being quarterly to being biannual to being annual and then to just not happening at all. And so I like truly overestimated my ability to turn it out in 3 months. I think it ended up taking 2 years from start to finish. But because of everything that happened, I realized that I didn't feel good about putting out an anthology of stuff that had been in the zine. Everything had changed so radically. So I asked people for new work. And that was a lot part of what took so long. I think of the zine, there's only one piece that was published in the zine proper, and that's Naomi's piece about Cynthia Brown. I think that's the only one. Yeah.
Nice.
Am I answering your question? I totally forgot what the question was.
Totally. I was just curious about like the origin story of putting the book together, and I was going to ask about PM Press and how you got connected with them too, because I love their work so much, and like that's how I got connected to your work. Is I was talking about another book they did, a biography of the punk band No Means No, and I got on their mailing list, and then this book came into my inbox and I was like, I want to do an episode on that book. That is a book that I want to feature in a conversation. So that's how I found you, is through my connection.
Amazing. I love that.
Yeah. So what is your situation like today involving discussions around adult sex work and like trafficking and things like that? Like, kind of, because it seems like you've shifted your role and your involvement a little bit into a little bit more of an activist stance and a little bit more of an awareness stance. So what's your situation like today?
Well, I'm in nursing school, so I really have cut back up until last fall. So fall 2023, I was like, I can do both. And then Israel attacked Gaza and I really pivoted to focusing on that and trying to like educate that and go to protests, and my grades went down. So I've been slowly trying to recover and not being very active at all. I still try to like use Instagram as a way to like share information and stuff, but I've had to really drastically cut back because like I just don't have the capacity to do it all. I really was like, I can, but I can't. But yeah, up until nursing school, I tried to stay really active, you know, testifying in like state legislature stuff, and working with people on research. And, I know people who are still doing research that I would love to be a part of, but I just can't balance it all. So I'm hoping that once I graduate, like I can either work with, there's like a local, street medicine team that works with unhoused people and like somehow mesh that with more organizing again, or I'm not sure. It seems like the possibilities, like with a healthcare degree, are pretty endless. So I'm hopeful that I can do something that integrates all of my interests.
Awesome. Well, you brought up, you just said the word legislature, so I'm going to pivot to legislation. You write in the book, there's extensive writing about something called the Mann Act, which I feel is super important, and I feel like that's something listeners might have no idea what that is. So can you tell me a little bit about what the Mann Act is and why it matters?
So the Mann Act is an early 20th century piece of legislation that basically was targeting sex workers. I should remember all of the details, but at this point I'm like, oh, it's the cardiac system that we're working on in school. So, it prohibited crossing state lines for the purposes of immoral acts. And it was, you know, at the time there was a lot of immigration of non-white people, or people that, you know, like Jewish people who were like maybe very peripherally white. And this country just had a really hard time with that. And so they started getting worried about like racial mixing, and the white slavery panic was blooming. And so they were trying to curb that. But obviously, like with a piece of legislation so broad, you know, you catch all these other people, you know, not just people who are abusing people, but, you know, like interracial marriages or, you know, young teenagers who just wanted to elope. And it never got repealed. It's still, you know, it's still the foundation for a lot of other anti-trafficking stuff that really resurged in the late 90s and early 2000s. Like, there wasn't as much of a worry about human trafficking for most of the 20th century. And then, you know, I think we started to, with globalization, the US started to worry once again about racial mixing, although no one wants to talk of, like, would phrase it like that anymore, but being really worried about, like, white women and children being abused. And so that foundation got laid and it never went away, and nobody ever really, you know, because we never addressed white supremacy or anything. So the rotten core was still there, and it's still rotting things to this day.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. That's a nice little overview. I like learning about stuff that I have no experience of, because if something doesn't, like, directly impact people, maybe they never even learn that these things exist mm-hmm. that might impact them in some way someday. You have an essay in the book that you wrote called Intimate Labor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I loved this essay. And since I was going to be doing the interview with you, I made sure to specifically read your work in a little bit, you know, extensive detail. And I'm curious about your hobby of asking women about what it would take for them to personally be involved in sex work, because I found that to be extremely captivating and a very, very interesting dissection of how people, what people can see themselves doing and not doing, and what those circumstances might look like. So tell me a little bit about this hobby of yours.
So I was in the club on a really slow night, and there was two guys and a bunch of women were in the same group, and they were, like, the only customers, and the women were just going crazy. They were having so much fun, which is great for them, where they were, like, flashing people, getting up on stage, you know, like, just trying to do the work of a stripper without, you know, getting paid. They were just giving it away for free. And so I was like, what would it take to get you up on stage to perform? You know, and they were like, $1 million. And that got me curious. So I was like, okay, well, what about a lap dance? Like, what would, you know, you're grinding on someone's dick for the cost of, you know, an electric bill. And they were like, no, $1 million, you know, just really outrageous sums that shows they weren't engaging with the actual idea of, like, you know, in 3 minutes, you can make an electric bill with minimum effort. And then what would you do? Like, instead of a 9-to-5 job, you would have all this free time if you were doing sex work, like, or, you know, you'd have a slow night at the club, but that would be too complicated to explain. So I was just like, you know, given the numbers, you know, like 500 for a half hour, would you do it? And the answer was no. And so I took it to Facebook and I was like, hey, for all of my non-sex working friends, like, what would it take to get you involved in sex work? Like, if you knew that you could make half your rent in a half hour, would you do it? And once again, you know, the answers were like, I would do it for $10,000 and he has to be hot. And I was just like, this is absurd. Like, why can't you, like, $10,000 and he has to be hot? But it made me realize, like, how disconnected most people are from, like, money. Money is just something that kind of virtually transfers and they don't really think about it. And, you know, they go to work and the money shows up in their bank account and they don't really think about, like, work or, like, you know, dating is work. You have to work to, like, put on a facade and go and be pleasant to people in the club or in the bar. And a lot of the people that you are pleasant to, like, a lot of guys are just not that attractive, you know, or, like, people would be like, I would only have sex with someone if he was hot for $10,000. I'm like, your boyfriend is uggo. What are you talking about? Like, this is like, what's the difference here? Like, emotionally, you'll have sex with someone who's ugly for free. Anyway, I was fascinated by it, and it hasn't gone away. Like, I was too annoyed by all of the answers to really, I stopped for a while. And also my friends were like, this is traumatic. Like, we have to do sex work. And we're seeing all these people talk about it like it's this, you know, fantasy. So I stopped asking for a long time. And then it's like a joke in nursing, you know, because in nursing we get abused a lot. You know, we get grabbed and groped, and men will be like, I can't hold my penis. Can you hold my penis for me? And so a lot of nurses will be like, I should just become a stripper. I should get an OnlyFans. Mm. And I was just like, do you know anything about what you're talking about? Like, people lose their jobs. Like, there was an EMT in New York who lost her job for having an OnlyFans. There was a nursing student here who got kicked out of nursing school when her past doing porn came out. And luckily she won. She sued and she won on Title IX. But just people's refusal to engage with any of the realities, like how stigmatizing it is, how much money you can potentially make, just makes me crazy.
Yeah, it seems like there's like this aura of like, I'm above this, and they're not like engaging in an intellectually honest manner or fashion with the facts on the ground. Does that make sense? Yeah. Like, it's like this pie in the sky expectation versus what the reality of it is for the people who actually do the work. And it's like a total disconnect and a refusal to actually engage with the facts.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just wild to me. Like, we're in such a hard time with inflation, rents rising and everything. Like, money is this hot commodity and people still can't like engage with, you know, how to make money. How do we make money? How does this affect people? Like, I know people who are staying together because they can't afford to like move house if they get divorced. So I'm like, you know, like, what are you doing? Not that they should turn to sex work, but like, that's an option that's out there that they just can't engage with because they are too, you know, morally, they think you would do something to them, I guess, or like spiritually, I don't really know. But I obviously like, I don't have that mindset. So yeah, it's really hard for me to fathom.
Yeah, it's really interesting too. I've actually been thinking about this recently, about how many couples who are living in high cost of living regions of the United States right now, how many of them who would otherwise get divorced if they lived in like a low cost of living place in like rural Kansas or something like that, and how much easier it would be for people to separate from relationships that are no longer fulfilling, but high cost of living is keeping them together. It's crazy. Interesting. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, just tangentially related to like circle back to trafficking. There was a piece of legislation passed here in like 2015 or 16 that expanded the definition of trafficking to anyone who exchanges sex for housing. And I was really against it because obviously there's a lot of like survival workers, you know, they don't need to be criminalized for doing that. But I talked to one of the people who lobbied for it, and she's really amazing. And she was like, well, actually our intent was to like loop in domestic violence survivors and protect them and offer them more resources so that they aren't stuck in relationships. And I was just like, oh, I really, like, I didn't think of that. There has to be a way to include these people without criminalizing, you know, like houseless youth and stuff. But yeah, it's a reality that like people don't think about.
I know that you had a government job where you had a hotline for sex workers. I would love to know a little bit about that work as well.
That was one of the most devastating experiences of my life. So I was part of lobbying for the passage of this bill that created like our ambitions for it. The National Association of Social Workers came to Portland and were like, we want to do something for Oregon sex workers. And the possibilities seemed really endless, but there are a lot of people who are anti-labor rights here and who are just like very much, you know, like strippers need to stay independent contractors. We're not exploited at all. Like this structure isn't exploitative. And so the two factions kind of warred it out, and the anti-labor rights ones won. And so it didn't end up being about labor protections. It ended up creating a hotline and a poster. And so the poster was supposed to go up into any club or like place where independent contractors worked, and with a definition of, you know, what makes an independent contractor, what makes an employee, so that people could be like, oh, I'm not, you know, an independent contractor, I'm treated as an employee, and then call the hotline. But the posters were really obscure. I'm sure I have a copy of it somewhere still, just to rub salt in that wound. And it was really unclear, you know, what that exploitation is so common. And they didn't even mail the posters out to most places. I got to Boley and I realized that the investment in actually making the hotline happen and have me do the job of working the hotline was zero. They had no intention of that. So really what I was the receptionist for the wage and hour division. And I answered phone calls about people who, you know, felt like they were being taken advantage of by their bosses, which was, it was super interesting. And it made me realize the scale of like agricultural trafficking in Oregon. But it wasn't anything to do with manning the hotline. And the hotline, like, I eventually quit because I was so upset that I wasn't doing my job. And that was it. They didn't hire anyone to replace me. It just kind of petered off.
Darn. I hate it when, when good ideas get invested in, but then not sustained, that really kind of, that stuff kind of drives me crazy, because so many good services that are worthwhile go that direction, don't they?
Yeah, we had a bill here, Measure 110. I mean, you probably heard about it, where we decriminalized certain amounts of drugs And the people who were put in charge say that they weren't given, they weren't given the resources to actually like create all of, or like push the, you know, the drug use rehabilitation, like substance use disorder clinics and stuff. And they quit because they were like, you're not actually invested in making this happen. And then it got repealed because everyone was like, it didn't work. And there was like, there was no investment in making it work. People didn't care. So, yeah.
Your chapter talks a little bit about violence and murder a little bit as well, which I know is, you know, difficult to talk about in a lot of ways. But, you know, what do listeners need to know that they maybe never considered about violence and sex work?
I feel like a lot of people have a stereotype that sex work is, you know, sex work is really dangerous. And it is, but it's not dangerous for the reasons, like, it isn't inherently dangerous to be having sex with people. You know, it's when you have a really marginalized population that doesn't have access to resources, that's working under the table, that's afraid to, you know, that knows that nobody will protect them or care if they get hurt. Then you have a population with who people who want to hurt people, they know that there's a population there that they can do that to. And they have an incentive, like Gary Ridgway, the Green River killer, he thought he was doing cops a favor by murdering prostitutes. And it's just, it's really easy to get taken advantage of and hurt. And so many places make it illegal to even like protect yourself. Like in England, you can't work together with another person or you're running a brothel. So you have to work alone. And so any basic safety measures that you would otherwise take, like they further criminalize you, you know? And that just makes it really risky. And if people really cared about ending violence against sex workers, ending violence against runaway teens or like vulnerable people, they would look into what actually causes the violence and offer protections. Like, I mean, criminalization isn't doing anything. That's what I think is so tragic. Like, it's like the war on drugs, you know, like criminalizing drugs hasn't stopped doing drugs. Abolition of prostitution isn't ending prostitution. It just pushes it further underground, but nobody wants to hear that. You know, it's much easier to further criminalize things.
Gotcha. Well, you know, this book is absolutely amazing. It's a really cool anthology and collection. What are some of your other favorite things that are in the book beyond the ones that you personally wrote? Do you have any like, really cool ones that you're like, these are my favorites. I love these.
I think it changes depending on my mood or like what I'm dealing with. Like there's times when I just love to push Janice Luna's, sex work is not therapy, or where she's, you know, she's a social worker and she talks about how people are like sex work is like therapy and the ways that it's not, because that's a common refrain, you know, among people who are like trying to get rights for sex workers but don't want to think too deeply about it all. They're like, we're just sacred healers, and I'm like, we're not. And then I love the final essay about just how to have hope and the possibilities of the radical imagination. Yeah, but really, I mean, they're all good. I picked them, so I love them all. It just, you know, it depends on the time of day, I guess.
Nice. Tell me a little bit about some of the friendships you've made in your work over the years, because you've had a variety of jobs where you're like doing the hotline, you know, actively involved in the industry yourself, being an activist, being an author and editing people's work. Like, tell me about some of the friendships that come from doing all the work that you've done.
I feel really lucky to have met the people that I've met, to have the people in my life that I do, because it's hard work. Like it's hard and stigmatized. It's funny. You make these friendships like in the club, in the dressing room, because it's this like pressure cooker basically, where, you know, you're really stressed out. You're trying to be sexy. And the only people who really understand it are the people who are going through it. Like if you get slapped by some guy, like you can't really commiserate to your non-sex worker friends, or you can, but there's a high chance that they'll be like, well, look what you do. It's just the other people who understand it. I'm still friends with some people from the club and we'll like reminisce or, you know, message each other. Like, can you believe this shit? But it also like, it's funny. A lot of those friendships die once you're not in that environment anymore and you don't have anything in common, you know, they don't last. So they're like really precious flowers that have to stay in their environment. And then, you know, I've met sex workers from around the world, and just because, you know, we gravitate towards each other. If you're doing something that not a lot of people are doing, you don't have a lot of people locally to talk about. So you hit the internet and look for people. And it's so amazing to hear what people, you know, in other countries are doing, what they're faced with, how they're dealing with it. This is such a generalization and it's not true. Like there's this tweet that's like, I don't support all queer people. Some of you bitches are really annoying. And I'm like, yeah, some of us are really annoying. It's true. But there's also so many amazing people doing such amazing things that I do feel a little bit of like rose-colored glasses about it. And like Janice Luna is a friend I've made through the book. I don't even know how I found her, but I was instantly like, you have to be in the book. And so we're talking about maybe editing another book, like once I graduate and have more time. And I would really hope that like we make that happen. But then I'm like, everything is so up in the air. You know, we live in such weird times. So I don't want to think about that too much until it's more firm.
Yeah. You, you mentioned non-sex work friends. Like, what are those relationships like for people who don't understand the line of work?
I have, you know, obviously I have some non-sex worker friends, and they're great. Like they're some of my best friends, but also there's times when like they will talk to me about sex work because it's such a huge part of my life. And I'm listening. I'm like, you still don't get it. You know, after 20 years, you still don't get it. And the way you're talking to me is really annoying. But after 20 years, I just feel like, okay, well, if they don't get it now, then I'm not really invested. Like this is just something I'll overlook. But I mean, luckily those moments are pretty few and far in between. And you know, everyone, even my dad came around. Like I devastated him initially. He was so heartbroken that I was a sex worker. And now he's just like, yeah, that's something you did. Like, you know, I wish you hadn't spent all your money on Stroll, but it is what it is. And that's really nice. But it also, it's sanity making to have somebody outside the industry sometimes. So like, you know, like when I was going to work and getting assaulted regularly and it was so normalized in the club that I had to have people outside be like, no, this isn't normal. Like, I know this is normal for your industry, but it's not normal. And it's not healthy and it shouldn't be happening. And that was really redeeming.
Mm. Well, one of the reasons why I really wanted to have this conversation is like, I feel like it's useful for me personally, to, you know, think about stuff that I have no awareness of. It just helps me grow as a person, but also to bring this conversation to a larger audience, you know, and get people thinking about this kind of stuff, get people thinking about the lives of sex workers. Just consider it. Think about it. Do you know what I mean? Be aware that these lives exist and that these lives are happening all around you, whether you pay attention or not. So that's kind of the reason why I wanted to chat with you about the book, because I just think it's really important for people to consider.
Yeah, it is. I appreciate that so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Where can people find more information about the book if you want to direct their attention to any social media or any websites or anything like that? I'd love to know where you would direct people's attention.
So for the book, you can get it through PM Press or really any bookseller. I think it's now distributed in Europe also. Yes, because my friend in Scotland has a copy. So, you know, you can get it online. You can get it in most bookstores. I mean, if a bookstore doesn't have it, they can order it. Third Place Books up in Seattle has been such a support of the book. I just appreciate them so much. I love you, Ani. And if you want to find out more about like sex worker stuff, I love what POC Swap is doing in Seattle, or the Green Light Project also in Seattle. Swap LA is doing amazing things. And then Strippers United is organizing strippers in LA, and they are the first strippers union in years. And really the first like strip club strippers union, because the Lusty Lady was a peep show in just a very different organizing environment. And then Blue Stockings in Seattle has a lot of sex worker organizers, and they are really supportive, and they also carry the book. Wait, did I just say Blue Stockings in Seattle? They're in New York. And yeah, and then Stroll has an Instagram, and mostly I post about Gaza right now, but I still try to post sex worker news as it comes up. And yeah. Oh, excellent. The Stroll Instagram is StrollPX at Instagram.
Excellent. Well, I am looking at PM's website right now, and if you buy the paperback, you get the ebook also for free. So there's I read the ebook, and it translates really well to Kindle. The layout is really wonderful. So if anybody's looking for it on an e-reader, like that's how I read it, and I blasted through it while I was actually sitting in an Avenged Sevenfold concert. So anyway, it's a really great book, an awesome anthology. Matilda Bickers, I'm just really grateful to you for your time and for telling me your story and for talking about the book. It means a lot. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much.